Nah. Mr. Pickering's an animal.
Yeah, it's fine. <for him. laughs> Ronnie, calm down. I'm riding it through town and it's shifting gears for me. Yeah, on my 6-7 grand mountain bike, I've got to shift the bloody gears.
Gearboxes, I said it. If it goes wrong, you are buggered.
We had rides like Martin Ashton on them back in the
never
day.
Heard of him.
Never heard of him. Winning bike races is not enough as an athlete anymore.
Hello and welcome to the Global Mountain Bike Show. On this week's episode, are traditional mech manufacturers dead? Are they done for? Hopefully not. We'll be looking at rider aid versus rider instincts and also discussing the next chapter for one of the most celebrated and prestigious mountain bike teams out there. Yes, hello and welcome to the show. Now, this week it is myself, Rich Payne. I'm joined by James Pickering, Adam Scroxton.
How are you?
Good, mate. How are you guys?
All right, thank you, yeah.
Right, the MGU, the motor gearbox unit hype train is in full effect, right? It's unavoidable in the mountain bike world. You cannot escape the gearbox chat.
My Instagram feed is full of it after Eurobike.
Isn't it just? It's overflowing, isn't it? So it did get me thinking, are traditional mech companies done for? Is the mech dead? Big question.
Personally, I don't think so. It's one of these things where I think this MGU is very much an electric bike product.
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to see it on pedal bikes yet.
Adam?
I think we've seen a couple of gearboxes pop up on normal bikes, but of like, yeah, bigger travel, so downhill bikes, some enduro bikes as well. But I think like James said, for shorter travel and lighter bikes, I think that derailleur is still going to be king.
Yeah, right. Well, what got me thinking was the big S's, Shimano and SRAM, have had a sort of stranglehold on the gearing market, if you like, for as long as I can remember, long time. I mean, I got some history for you here. In the 1970s, the 5-speed freewheel came along. In the 80s, Dior XT was introduced. In the 90s, we had 3x8 and 3x9. Early 2000s, saw 3x9 get refined. 08 kind of period, 2x10. And then from there, we switched to 1x drivetrains, 1x11, well, 1x10 to begin with, 11, now 12, along with electronic shifting as well. But you know what? Like, while Shimano and SRAM have had a stranglehold on it, they have experimented with internal gear devices, if you like, in the past, haven't they?
Yeah, I guess this is nothing new, really. Like, I worked in bike shops and you had the Nexus 7-speed hub drive gear with a belt. And on a lot of other town bikes, there's other systems, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, like that Shimano system, that's been around for ages and it's been pretty bomb-proof, if I'm honest.
Yeah, like, the Alphine as well, right? Yeah. These are really popular on kind of commuter bikes.
And
a few companies have actually experimented with them on off-road bikes. Zero tried it on a downhill bike, things like that. So there has been experimentation. But, you know, these guys have roughly 99% of the market share, which is humongous, like a full monopoly on it, a humongous amount.
Yep.
And they've both pushed each other in terms of sort of advancements. You know, we see one do something, the next one, they one-up it. Yeah. We saw a 50-tooth bigger sprocket, someone makes a 51.
Yeah, electric.
Exactly,
weight,
right?
Like, all this stuff. You need these rivals to drive, like, the competition, don't you?
You do, and I think that's what they've had. But now we're seeing new players come in, right?
But, my sort of question is, like, I ride a derailleur all the time. They're so flipping good now.
Yeah.
Like, where's the demand for a gearbox? Because I think mountain bike group sets, like you've got, talking about the Qs on your...
On my e-bike.
On your e-bike.
Yeah.
What's £250 group set all in?
If not a bit less. And I put it on that Retro Giant, do you remember, as well?
And it shifts so flipping well. It's like, I kind of... Maybe I just don't know enough about it, but why do we need gearboxes on our bikes?
All right, well, that, I mean, a loaded question right there. Yeah. Do you want to have a dive in?
Oof.
I mean, reliability.
Yeah, reliability. Yeah. So they've got, well, they're spoken of having really long service windows, which makes a lot of sense because they are sealed units. So think British winter where it's all really muddy. Well, what the conditions that would absolutely trash your traditional drivetrain with your chain, your derailleur, your cassette.
Yeah.
If that's all now within this sealed unit, away from all of that, that can make a lot of sense there.
Yeah.
And as well with the gearbox systems, because you're putting the gears inside versus chain and derailleur. How many people do you know with e-bikes that are snapping chains?
Yeah, my dad did.
Really?
Yeah. And he's got a Bosch system and he was umming and ahhing about putting the 120 newton meter update on. I was like, well, you did just snap your chain, didn't you, Dad?
Yeah.
So I was like, maybe hold back on that.
Mr. Pickering's an animal.
Yeah, he's flying through him. Ronnie, calm down.
But on your point there, yep. You know, essentially, you know, Honda are kind of, I don't want to call them the first to do this, but Honda brought a gearbox, or what people thought at the time was a gearbox, to light in the World Cup circuit, yeah, in the early 2000s, the RN01. It turned out just to be a mech in a box. It was really simple in the long run, but no one knew that until they released that data.
Yep. Yeah.
But everyone was suddenly thinking, oh, it's a gearbox. Like, what is this wizardry, right?
Yeah.
Now, from then on, we saw Pinion, who I think Pinion were founded in 08, made in Germany by a couple of ex-Porsche engineers who basically wanted to, like, a drivetrain to work more like a car drivetrain. That was their ethos, the goal behind it. And Pinions, I would say, are pretty popular now. They're found on quite a lot of e-bikes again.
Yeah, and we've seen that Afton's invested loads and loads of time and money in trying to develop that Pinion into their downhill bike.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, there's a Gates belted drive purse
isn't there? Yeah.
100 grand up to whoever takes a UCI Elite Downhill World Cup win.
And we've got quite a few teams running the Gates belt now, haven't we?
It's on a Pinion gearbox. So.
Yeah. It's not as unique as it used to be. And there is the obvious benefits of there's a lot of downhill teams adding weight to their BBs now. Well, it's like, if you've got a Pinion gearbox by your bottom bracket, I think that's one of the things Charlie Hatton spoke about, was how well the bike rode with all the weight down there. Because I guess that's the problem why you can't run a Nexus or an Alphine 7-speed a hub gear, because it's right at the back of the bike, so it feels terrible.
Yes, so it unbalances the bike.
And in an e-bike, like, the weight's down at the BB anyway, so if you've got a gearbox there as well.
Yeah, adding some sprockets or whatever wizardry's in there is not going to make too much of an odds. So, I mean, that being said, this tech, you know, like we said, Pinion 08, we saw the mech in a box from Honda back in the early 2000s. We've seen other examples previously. So it's not unknown technology. And in fact, all this has come to light, if you like, at this latest Eurobike. But we even saw it at last year's Eurobike, a brand called Uhuru. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Had a very similar thing. It was essentially a ECVT.
That's the one.
Thank you. I had to think about the letters in order. Thank you.
I just could see the gearbox working in your brain.
Literally, my own internal gearbox was going there. ECVT, which stands for?
Electronic Constant Variable Transmission.
Thank you, Adam.
So instead of your traditional sort of splines meshing together, you've essentially got two, as I understand it, like conical, let's just call them gears.
Yeah.
For now. With a belt in between, and it's sort of constantly changing angle, so you are running the same ratio, like, as you keep going. And with these E systems, I think it works. So you've got a motor driving the chainring, and a separate one driving that sun gear, so the other side of that conical setup there. But what it essentially means is you can ride at one cadence, so keep your legs spinning at the same rate the entire time you're riding, and it's like seamless shifting.
There's
no steps.
Yeah.
Which is what Pinion is, like a more traditionally shifted gearbox. So.
Yeah.
I don't want to harp on about the gearboxes, because we could go on about this for hours.
Yeah.
And this tech isn't, again, you know, it's fairly common in other markets. In fact, James has ridden a bike with it on.
Yeah, so...
Right, you have?
Kind of. I guess most major cities will have them. In the UK and London, we have the Lime bike. They're the sort of town bikes you go up to, you've got your phone app, you scan the QR code and you can just ride them off. And I was riding one for the first time. I was looking for the gear shifter, and it just doesn't have one. And depending on your speed and cadence, it will shift gears for you. Now, it's not quite as advanced as that system.
No.
But I was like, I'm on a Lime bike.
Which you've hired for a few quid.
Yeah, it's £4 or £5.
Yeah.
I'm riding it through town, and it's shifting gears for me. I'm like, yeah, on my 6-7 grand mountain bike, I've got to shift the bloody gears.
But that, I mean, that goes to show, like, so the tech is there, and it's already out there in various other markets and things.
Yeah.
So why is it taken for Avinox or Gabal, which we'll get onto, such a humongous brand to finally put it into the limelight, to finally bring it to a place where we're adopting it in the mountain bike world.
The e-bike market is massive now. We're constantly being told how the e-bike market is such a large proportion of the overall off-road bike sales. Mm. Like, there's, it wouldn't really work on a, for years, like 10 years ago, it wouldn't have worked on a pedal bike, hence why people weren't really pushing for it on a pedal
too
bike.
Too heavy, really. Drag but resistance,
because
yeah.
Like, I guess this is why Shimano and SRAM might want to get involved, is like, e-bikes are such a large part of the market that if you're going to invest into sort of a drivetrain unit, e-bikes is where you need to do it, right?
Yeah well, go on, Adam.
Because I was wondering with the whole, you remember when UDH came out?
Yeah.
Like, oh, why has this happened? And then T-Type came out a couple of years later from SRAM, and it immediately fitted to that system.
That's so, a universal derailleur hanger, yeah.
So I'm thinking, is Avanox that launching the M2 and M2S motors then going to have the motor gearbox unit fit in place of it, almost like they're using their current setup as a Trojan horse for that?
Yeah. Oh, I see. So like universal mounts for their
motor system. Yeah, everyone ready for it.
Well, touching back on your point about Shimano and SRAM again, is they haven't been like sleeping when it comes to, I don't want to say gearboxes, but electronic shifting. Obviously, they've both had their DI2 and Access kind of wireless group sets for a fair while now. And they've both integrated into their own motor systems that they have. So the SRAM Powerchain, Shimano's EP kind of range of motors.
Yeah.
They've both integrated their gearing so it runs off the main battery. They have things like auto shift.
Yep. Yeah.
They have coast shift on SRAM as well. Now, are they going to need to pull their finger out here to compete, especially in the e-bike world? But are we going to see like them a little bit more worried in the analog world, or are they going to get a bit worried, do you think?
I think maybe on more utility bikes where weight isn't necessarily an issue, that's where they'll need to worry. On like performance bikes, like we were saying, like your XC bikes, your downcountry, your trail bikes, I think maybe they will stick with derailleur and a traditional drivetrain for a bit longer.
Yeah, right. It makes sense on a cargo bike, doesn't it? If you're riding your cargo bike through town, you've got two kids on the front, you're shopping. If you can take away the need to change gear.
Yeah.
And because like, we've all been riding bikes all our, if you're buying an $8,000 bike, chances are you know how to shift a gear, right? It's like,
you thought, yeah, probably. Yeah.
But it's like, if you're just buying a cargo bike and getting ever more popular, you might have not been a lifelong cyclist. You might not know about how to change gears. And I guess it's the same with like automatic cars, right? It's like, there's probably going to be a whole new generation of people after us who never learn how to drive a manual car.
So do you think the investment, because they both obviously must have invested massive amounts of money into their motor systems.
Yeah.
Do you think they're just going to let them fizzle out? Or do you think they're going to focus on their mechanical drivetrains? You know, we've just seen a new XT, massive fanboy. XT come out here. Like, so are they going to, we saw actually, what's the new 90, the mechanical SRAM system that's come out called? 90?
Oh, Eagle 90. Yeah. Again, you know, really good.
A brand new mechanical group set. So obviously there is money into mechanical stuff still.
I don't think it would fizzle out. I think the derailleur is so important. You will not be able to get a gearbox system as light as a derailleur setup. Yeah. And it's like, I did a cross-country race on Sunday and the group set I was using was absolutely flawless. Like, I was shifting under load, no mechanical sympathy. Yeah, like it wears out a bit and you have to do maybe a bit more maintenance, but it was shifting amazingly. And I was thinking, I was like, why the hell would I need anything more than what I've got now?
All right. Food for thought. Let us know in the comments down below. If an MGU or a ECVT system were to be available on your bike and you had been off the mech straight away, would you? Let us know. Okay, moving on then, gents. Rider aids, things that help your riding versus rider instinct. With all the advancements in tech going on at the moment, are we losing that kind of natural mountain biking feel? Adam, what do we think?
So yeah, it's kind of the tech getting bolted onto these bikes now. Is it actually innovative or is it invasive? Mm-hmm. So I understand, they're going on bikes to potentially help people. Again, I think you touched on people that may be using a bike in place of a car.
Yeah.
And there will be people that just want to get from A to B as simply as possible, maybe just like tune out of little bits and focus on other bits of the riding experience. But when we're ultimately using, well, we are at least using these bikes to escape the noise and everything.
Yeah, yeah. For leisure, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That sort of raw riding experience, are these detracting from that?
And we're sort of talking things like ABS.
That as well,
like auto shift, stuff like that. It's a tough one because, yeah, for a lot of people, a bike is just a mode of transport.
Yeah.
There's this whole thing of, like, a lot of people talk about, like, driving retro cars versus driving, like, you drive a modern BMW and it's got lane assist, it's got adaptive cruise control, it's got all stuff like this. Or you can, a lot of people just want to get in an old car, they just drive it, none of this, no cruise control. Mm. So it's about whether you want that, like, that driving feel, or if you just want to be able to switch off and doing it. I guess a lot of us ride mountain bikes because we want the sort of the sensation and the feel of the trail and the input to it, right?
Yeah, it's the escapism and sort of that connection, I suppose, between bike and nature. I think a lot of, I certainly do like, but I do sympathise with anyone who says they like the rider sort of rider aid side of it as well, like the gizmometry. I do like a bit of tech.
Yeah. And you were saying earlier your motorbike's got like your
traction control and different modes on it. Yeah,
that doesn't take away from the riding experience, right?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, and that's like, if anything, it's like what we've all got in performance cars now. There's so many computerised bits, but it makes the experience better, maybe.
Do you think?
I don't know.
I'm maybe looking at this too negative, particularly with the car sort of analogy as well. Because the cars we drive, it's a much more sort of immersive experience. Like the inputs you have.
My old van is a very immersive experience because I feel like I'm holding on for dear life down the motorway.
Exactly.
It's not my choice.
So I'm thinking it's a more engaging experience.
Engaging is one way of putting it.
Yeah. So then you're concentrating more. Whereas with a modern car, it's very easy to go very quickly with bad habits, and the car will just like compensate for it.
Yeah.
So yeah.
My concern with all this stuff on bikes is particularly like ABS.
Yeah.
Are we going to get a generation of riders that are particularly like ham-fisted?
Maybe. Because I actually, like, one of the things I grew up riding, and a lot of people probably got into me, I grew up riding BMX, and I had no brakes on my bike, I had no gears on my bike, and it's a very raw style of riding. A lot of people ride dirt jump bikes, again, one gear, one brake.
Fixies.
And it's this very, like, raw style of riding. And yeah, if you've got a bike that changes gear for you, you've got ABS systems, you've got
electronic suspension.
Yeah, I don't know if it, because we're all like guilty of being a bit salty sometimes. Of like, oh, kids these days are so good; they're doing this at 12. We didn't have good kids bikes when we were younger. Yeah. But I don't know if that's a bad thing, that like riders are going to get better because they've got these aids. Yeah. I don't know if that's a bad thing.
There's another point I've got with it that everything's going to be like, it's super integrated into bikes now. So I'm thinking things like that Orbea Rallon RS, where everything's sort of wired into one central battery and just...
Very clever bike.
Very clever bike. But think it more broadly with everything sort of wired into one system. If one tiny little bit of it goes wrong, does that then knock out the rest of the bike?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've not ridden one of those, but I should imagine when you've got a system that is so connected, well, if your bike battery runs flat, what happens then? Again, I haven't ridden one, so I'm not entirely sure. I'd have to find out.
I guess bikes are less easy to work on in a way, but I think that's actually just life now. Your car's less easy to work on. Like,
well, I was going to bring this up, maintenance, actually, because on all these additional, I'm just going to say it, gizmometry that we do have on our bike, the maintenance is way harder, right? Yeah. So in fact, actually, yes, we go gearboxes, I said it, you know, way simpler to work on. But if, and that's just an if it goes wrong, you are buggered, right? Yeah. Like you're done for.
Yeah, and like I like tech on my bike and like power meters, head units, blah, blah, blah. I'll sometimes head out for a ride and I've had it before where your power meter won't connect to your head unit. And that is so bloody annoying. Whereas it's like, if you strip everything back, it's the simplicity of it. It's easy. And I guess it's, I don't know. Is simplicity better?
Well, I was just going to, are we a tech-driven community? I mean, we're all guilty. Us in here, Mike behind the camera, I can see him. We're all guilty of loving a gizmo, of loving a latest and greatest, you know.
But say gearboxes do become the latest and greatest thing. So you got your home mechanic who currently can fix mechanical derailleur, can fix drivetrains, whatever. So all of that gets sealed in an internal thing.
Yeah.
At the point that needs work, that's going to have to go to a shop, to a service centre, which will then have its own like queue of work to do, which should then also be sat in a queue waiting for parts, Whereas with the traditional drivetrain, you can pop down to your local bike shop or worst case, order it online, wait a couple of days, and you can have it fixed in a couple of days.
Yeah, but I guess the argument is that you can get 10,000 kilometres out of one pre-service, whereas I had a certain derailleur manufacturer on a bike one season when I was racing. I had to service it every 3 weeks.
Yeah. So I mean, we could go round in circles a lot on this because I'm going to throw it out there. For me, I do love a gizmo, but too many, and it's just a bit frustrating. I do still like that natural feeling of just me, the bike, maybe an electronic mech, you know, wireless dropper's pretty cool, stuff like that. But if I start getting into ABS, electronic suspension, and you start putting all that together, I think I'd have to draw the line.
That's the thing for me. I think when I have to start thinking about said gizmo, that's when it gets annoying for me.
Yeah.
When it's like just very seamlessly integrated, like an electronic group set, other than having to charge it, I don't have to like think about how I use said gizmo. Yeah. It's just like seamless. All right.
Subtle gizmos, no gizmos, or all the gizmos. Let us know in the comments down below. All right, moving on. Sadly, you could call this the end of an era, the death of an icon, or I like to think of it as the celebration of what was possibly one of the greatest mountain bike teams out there. Cannondale Factory Racing are shutting up shop after 30 years, right, James?
Yeah, so this has mainly affected their cross-country team. So the news has hit them last week that after 30 years of sponsorship, 2026 is going to be the last season of Cannondale Factory Racing. So they've even got series leader Luca Martin on the team right now. They've got riders like Yolanda Neff, Charlie Aldridge. So
big hitters.
Yeah, big hitters. They're probably like the leading cross-country team. So it came as a bit of a surprise to me. I want to just start by saying like a massive shout out to Cannondale for supporting mountain biking and mountain bike racing over the last 30 years. We had riders like Martin Ashton on them back in the
day. Never heard of him.
But they've supported, and we've seen some of the best talents in mountain biking on their team over the last few years. But I think this is actually part of some bigger industry changes for Cannondale. So this isn't kind of just them saying, we're not asked about racing anymore. It's actually, they're having a few financial difficulties. So I believe they're actually shutting one of their assembly factories in the Netherlands. They're going to do that by the end of 2027. So it's going to be 120 redundancies. Yeah. They've stopped with their UK distributor Saddleback. So they're obviously having a few financial difficulties, as a few people are in the industry at the moment. But one of the main hits has been the shot of Cannondale Factory Racing. And they've actually announced that they're going to go for more of a sort of content creator, ambassador style program.
Yeah, so they're shifting focus, basically.
That's what they've got. So they've got something called the Cannondale Rogues they're going to start now. And they want it to be more community-based. There's still going to be athletes on it. So that'll be people like Lachlan Morton are on that and stuff like that.
More individuals though, right?
Yeah,
across
more individuals.
A broader spectrum of the mountain bike world.
But what I was thinking about is this sort of the end? Are we going to see the end of factory racing? Because the costs are getting higher and higher for World Cup teams. I think it's now €40,000 to register a World Cup team for the year. It's €150 per rider per round. So just to enter your team and enter your riders, we're looking at €50,000-€60,000 a year.
Yeah.
Then you've got to get to the venue. They're all over the world now, which is great. But South Korea, Canada, US, sometimes South America, so that costs a lot. We've got big trucks we're seeing.
Yeah, logistics. Yeah. Other team members, you know, staff,
they've
wages.
Got more, nutritionists, physiotherapists, managers, mechanics.
I mean, even just the bikes, the amount of equipment alone adds up.
Mm. Yeah, and it's like, I don't know, is there as much value in that now as there used to be? You know, in the 90s, the people who were winning the World Cups, they were the guys who you wanted and girls. The bikes, that like, if Steve Peat went on a Santa Cruz, you wanted a Santa Cruz. Mm. But is that like, I think if you ask Joe Bloggs at a trail centre on a weekend who won the last World Cup, does he know? Does he know what bike they're on?
So to me, you've got two different markets in there. You've got like the racers, you've got the more serious mountain bikers, we'll call them, who are into racing, who are into performance and weight and things like that, who want the lightest bike, the most efficient bike, the one that's snappiest off the line, things like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then you've got like the guys and girls who just want to shred at the weekend and just ride laps. Yeah. And they're probably more influenced by the influencers, right?
Yeah.
They're not influenced by, they don't look at a racer and go, oh, wow, you know, they averaged X amount of watts and that bike's super light and stuff like that. They're like, oh man, did you see that person shroud up that turn on a new bad habit or whatever? They're like, oh, I want that bike kind of thing.
And I think now it's like R&D has developed so much. Do we need athletes to develop bikes anymore? So we've got telemetry, we've got feedback from suspension brands.
Gizmos.
We've got gizmos. We've got gizmos. It's like 20 years ago, you probably worked very closely with a group of athletes to develop bikes. I'd probably argue that, I wouldn't know, but I think you wouldn't rely as much on a set individual to develop your bike anymore.
Yeah, a few thoughts on this one, isn't it? Because I think the problem that some teams have is you've got like a divide. I mean, you've got like a team that might be performing really well, but ain't cool.
So
you're like, they got real cool bikes, they're doing really well, but they ain't a cool team kind of thing. Yeah. And you've got teams that might be not doing very well, but they've got some really cool riders, where again, you kind of one without the other. But then you have got like that holy grail of like a winning team with cool riders.
Like Santa Cruz Syndicate.
Bingo bango, got it in one, right?
And I think they've always done it, but it's something
like Trek,
that,
I think, a good example.
Yeah, it's like now more than ever, you have to do both. Winning bike races is not enough as an athlete anymore. Yeah. You have to win bike races, you have to do all your media stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, if you win a bike race, but you don't have an Instagram account, I'd argue you'd be struggling for content.
Yeah, so here go. There's my issue, is that I actually thought the Cannondale team was pretty cool.
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
like I thought they were a pretty cool like group of riders and stuff, and blooming good at the same time.
Yeah,
so that makes my theory there almost fall on itself.
Yeah,
because actually they have got both of those, but I guess at the end of the day, money's money. If you ain't got it or need to save it,
and they're not the only sort of team that I've fallen short to financial difficulties and industry sort of difficulties. We've had sort of famously Whitey over the last few years, Madison Saracen, we were talking about this morning. So it's probably part of what might be a slightly bigger shift in mountain biking over the next decade or so. And I think this is almost a problem that's happened from Warner Brothers trying to make mountain bike racing more elitist and more premium.
Just top end.
Top end is that like, that's brilliant, and it's cool to see it become an F1, but F1 costs, right?
A lot of money, a lot of money. Interestingly, I think there's a connection there between the race teams who have ceased to exist. I mean, there are others in there, CRC, Da Vinci, Nukeproof. Yeah. I mean, Nukeproof are back, but...
Yeah.
And financial struggles within the business, right? I think, like, there is a strong connection there of companies who are still doing well and who still drive sales through performance and racing, but that's not to say that it works. But I want to get, can we circle back a bit as well though? So what they're planning on doing now, it's called the
Cannondale Rogues.
And this isn't something brand new for them, because they actually had the Cannondale Waves kind of squad back in the 2020s-ish, late 2010s.
So that started when Josh Bryson left Santa Cruz. He joined Cannondale and then he sort of had his own program for a bit, and then he took on sort of a group of mates. It's quite free ride based. Yeah. So Sam Hockenhall, Sam Cafano, and Freedom.
Yeah.
And they were very raw. It was like skate style edits. Whereas this new program they're going to do is riders from all different types of disciplines, gravel, mountain biking, road. And it's very like community and content based, but it's not going to be like as raw as that sort of Cannondale Waves program.
A little more higher end production.
I get the impression, yeah. But I think, I don't know, it's not all doom and gloom, because there are a lot of brands still investing a lot of money into racing.
Yeah.
We've got sort of Canyon famously offered, well, and he signed it, Matthew Vanderpoel is on a lifetime contract with
That's
Canyon.
That's mad when you think about it, isn't it?
So, and they've sponsored Movistar for 13 years. They're like a road cycling team. They've got Canyon SRAM they've been on for 10 or 11 years. So I think, while some brands are leaving racing, we do also have brands that are still really backing racing.
Yeah, and we're seeing like non-cycle brands. We talked about it last week briefly, but non-cycle brands investing in mountain biking. Ford was the prime example with the Rock Rider team. So interesting. All right, well, I mean, it's sad to see them go, but kind of they've done amazing things over the years. Let us know what your thoughts are on this in the comments down below. Racers, influencers, which do you prefer? maybe you don't care at all. But let us know. Thank you very much for watching this. It's been another great show. And until next time, we'll see you later.